from NPR and WBUR Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. There is so much darkness and strife in the news these days. Politics, war, coronavirus. Sometimes it honestly feels like it's all too much. So today, we just want to take an hour to be uplifted, to revel, to be inspired. And that is why we are going to celebrate this woman.
I felt most proud of the success of the Apollo mission. They were going to the moon. I computed the path that would get you there. You determined where you were on Earth when you started out and where the moon would be at a given time. We told them how fast they would be going, and the moon would be there by the time you got there.
Katherine Johnson. I love the way she says, we calculated it, and the moon would be there by the time you got there. Well, you heard her. She computed the path that would get Americans to the moon. Johnson was one of what NASA once called human computers. In the earliest days of the space program, they calculated flight paths, trajectories, launch windows to hurl human beings into space and then get them back safely. Now, some of these computers were African-American women. They were mathematicians who did all of that work by hand. Through their vast mathematical brilliance and their profound perseverance, Americans walked on the moon. Well, Katherine Johnson died last week at the age of 101. Today, we'll remember her. So this hour on Point, the life and legacy of Katherine Johnson. And we're joined today from Charlottesville, Virginia, by Margot Lee Shetterly. She's author of Hidden Figures, The American Dream, and the Untold Story of the Black Women Mathematicians Who Helped Win the Space Race. It was a best-selling book, and of course, also Hidden Figures became a movie in 2016. So Margot Lee Shetterly, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Meghna. Thanks so much for having me on.
It is great to talk to you again. Sadly, though, regarding the passing of Katherine Johnson, but what a giant. What a giant in American history. How are you feeling now that she's gone?
It's a moment of sadness. I mean, I think we felt in a way that she would live forever. And to say goodbye to her is a very sad occasion. Obviously, we're all thinking of her family at this time. But it is also an opportunity to celebrate an incredible person. And like you said, her story really does bring us optimism and light.
Absolutely. So tell us, what do you think, I mean, she would have said she felt was her greatest accomplishment during her many years at NASA?
Well, as you played in that clip, and as I think, I asked her, and I think other people have asked her that question, and she really felt that contributing the calculations to the parking orbit of the Apollo 11 mission was what she considered her greatest achievement. Of course, the one that she's most known for, the one that was really kind of immortalized, I suppose you could say, in the Hidden Figures movie, was calculation of the trajectory of astronaut John Glenn's flight, his orbital flight, pioneering flight, in February of 1962. But she considered her contributions to Apollo 11 to be her greatest achievement.
Okay, so we'll talk about Apollo 11 in a few minutes, but tell us more about that John Glenn flight. I mean, what exactly did she do, and how did she end up being the person who did it?
Well, it's very interesting. You know, Katherine Johnson started working at NASA Langley. It actually was called the National Advisory Committee for Aeronautics. That's the name of the agency. And the outpost there in Hampton, Virginia, which is where I grew up, was called the Langley Memorial Aeronautical Laboratory. Her first job when she got there in 1953 was working on airplanes. And it happened that that group of that engineering group that she started out with eventually became one of the groups most closely affiliated with the Project Mercury in the early space program. So, her job evolved as that group evolved from working on flight tests for airplanes into figuring out how, first of all, to put a human into orbit and then to send a man to the moon. She, she was a mathematician by training as an undergraduate and then as a graduate student. She taught math in public high school. Public elementary schools and middle schools in the state of Virginia, segregated at that time. And it was really only until, you know, she was sort of well into her 30s, mid-career, that she started taking the steps to what would be her best work and what we know her for. So she, in 1962, as the United States was really scrambling to catch up with the Soviet Union, which had managed not only to put put an astronaut into space, but to send an astronaut into orbit around the Earth. It was that point when John Glenn had been selected for the orbital flight that this group of engineers that Katherine Johnson was working with were assigned to the portion of the mission that involved the flight paths. Katherine Johnson had actually co-authored the research report that laid out all of that math, and so it was very natural when the theoretical became actual, you know, as this hypothetical mission became a real thing with a real astronaut, that she would be the one to work on it. And as they were doing, you know, as you can imagine, a mission like this requires many, many pre-flight checklists.
Oh, yeah.
You know, you want to make sure everything is right. Among them was making sure that the output for the computer, and this is a time unlike today when computers are integrated to everything we do, this was a relatively new thing, that she would do a hand check of all of the equations that had been programmed into the computer to calibrate that and make sure it was correct. And John Glenn, as the person whose life was on the line here, went to the engineers in that particular group and said, listen, get the girl, meaning Katherine Johnson, the computer, and the computers were overwhelmingly female at that time, get her to check the numbers as a part of our pre-flight checklist. And that is what she did. And that is the moment very dramatically portrayed in the movie. But it is also a moment that happened in real life.
Right. Well, we are remembering Katherine Johnson, the pioneering mathematician, who died last week at the age of 101. You know, Margo, you mentioned the dramatic moment in the movie Hidden Figures, where John Glenn says he's not going up unless Katherine Johnson checks out those numbers. We have that scene here, so I just want to have people listen to it. So this is from the 2016 film Hidden Figures, and you're going to hear astronaut John Glenn, played by Glenn Powell, saying that though the numbers computed by the machines needed to be double-checked by Katherine Johnson.
The IBM's been spot on up to this point, John, but we'll run it again, see what it comes up with.
Look, I'm going to be honest with you, Al. When I fly the machine.
And right now, it seems like this machine's flying me.
We're on the same page, John. Our guys are on it.
Let's get the girl to check the numbers.
The girl?
Yes, sir.
You mean Katherine?
Yes, sir. The smart one. I mean, she says they're good. I'm ready to go.
A scene from the movie Hidden Figures. Now, here's how Katherine Johnson, as Margo pointed out, spoke about it in reality. This is from the TV series Makers.
At a given time, you tell him to descend with mathematical equations. And if he descends the way you tell him, he'll hit the water when you tell him. He had confidence in what we had computed for him, and he had to do it just as we said.
That's Katherine Johnson speaking on the TV series Makers. You know, Margo, I suppose in 2020, it's actually kind of hard or very hard to imagine that these astronauts, as you mentioned, they actually did not trust the electronic machines that were doing these computations because they knew they were putting their lives on the line and they felt more confident in the precision and the care and the brilliance of these women in particular. I mean, that is so remarkable to me in this day and age when I'm sitting at a desk now that's got several computers under it that have more computational power than every machine that was probably in the United States in the 1960s. It's so amazing. Did Katherine Johnson ever talk to you about, did she feel the weight of that responsibility at the time?
She did. She certainly did. And she felt the pressure to get the numbers right because she knew that those numbers being right meant that the mission would be successful. Everyone's little part, and there were so many parts to this mission, so complex. She had to have her numbers, her part of it, be accurate and precise, and that is what contributed to the overall success of the mission. So absolutely, she talks about the pressure that she felt. At the same time, when you ask her about that job and about that mission and about, I guess, the feeling of stress and, you know, all of those things, she always says, you know, I was just doing my job and I always did my job well. Mm. So she had a standard of excellence for every single thing that she did. And this was no different. Obviously, the stakes were higher, but she was somebody who brought that standard of excellence to everything that she did.
We've got about a minute to go before the break, but I have to ask you, can you tell us just a little bit more about Katherine Johnson's love of mathematics? Was it there for her from birth?
It really was. When she talks about growing up in rural West Virginia, she was someone who counted everything. She counted dishes. She counted stars. She loved numbers. She loved math. And she was incredibly curious. And I think that that combination of a very independent, curious mind and mathematical talent made her the perfect person for the job that eventually found her. You know, I mean, this wasn't a job that was available when she first came out of college, but eventually she and the job joined forces at NASA in 1953. And when she talked about the work that she did, she said she loved every single day at NASA and speaking with her about the work that she did, whether it was airplanes or John Glenn's flight or the space shuttle, she loved every single day.
Well, we are remembering Katherine Johnson today. She died last week at the age of 101. There's much more to talk about when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are taking an hour to remember Katherine Johnson today. She was the pioneering NASA mathematician whose hand calculations helped put Americans on the moon, one of a cadre of brilliant African-American women who were revealed to the rest of us through the book Hidden Figures, The American Dream and the Untold Story of the Black Women Mathematicians Who Helped Win the Space Race. That book is by Margot Lee Shetterly, and she joins us today. Katherine Johnson died last week at the age of 101. And joining us now from Norfolk, Virginia, is Christine Darden. Christine worked at NASA from 1967 until 2007. She worked alongside Katherine Johnson, Mary Jackson, and Dorothy Vaughan. She started as a computer at NASA's Langley Research Center. She was technical leader of NASA's Sonic Boom Group. And in 2019, she was awarded the Congressional Gold Medal. Christine Darden, it's such a privilege to speak with you. Welcome to On Point.
Hello, Meghna. It is wonderful to be here with you today.
So tell us.
Remembering Katherine.
Yeah. How are you remembering her today?
I've lost a friend. We were very good friends. I've known her for 50 or so years. Went to church with her all of those years also, sang in the choir with her. So I knew her, and I knew her children, her daughters. One of her daughters was my classmate all through college.
So what is it that you want the rest of us to know about Katherine?
Katherine was a very outgoing person, a very welcoming person, and I could imagine, I'm an introvert, but when I would see Katherine at conferences and everything, Katherine would be out mixing with all of the people and talking to the people, and she was just well-liked because of her outgoing personality, and Catherine had events after I got to NASA, in card parties on federal holidays or something like that, in which she would invite the West computers, those who had worked in the segregated environment. And that's how I met them, because, of course, that was not the way NASA was when I started work there in 67.
That it was not segregated when you were there?
No, it was not. It said the segregation ended about the time that NACA was turned into NASA after the Russian satellite went up.
Okay. So Margo, let me just turn back to you here for a second to give us a little bit of background about what Christine just said. Because when the first African-American women began working for NASA in what, the early 40s, it was most definitely segregated then, right?
Yeah, absolutely. It was 1943. They were hired in as a group, interestingly, and they had been trained during World War II at Hampton University, what was then called Hampton Institute, historically black college in Hampton, Virginia, Dr. Darden's alma mater, also Mary Jackson's alma mater. So, you know, an institution that has had a long history of turning out outstanding African-American professionals. And they trained these first women as a part of the war training at World War II, who then went over and as a group were the first employees in what was called the West Area Computing Area. Now, they were doing the same work as the white women who had been hired at that time. The difference was that because of both Virginia state law and social custom in the United States at that time, they were racially segregated.
Mm. Okay. And then when did that end?
That really ended when the NACA, the National Advisory Committee for Aeronautics, in 1957 became NASA, the National Space Agency that we knew today, which was precipitated by acceleration in the space race after the Russians put the Sputnik satellite into orbit. So there is a memo that I found. You know, I spend a lot of time in the National Archives looking through documents, trying to put this story back together. And the document that I found, there were 9 women still left in the West Area Computing Group who hadn't been sort of given a permanent placement in different engineering groups. And prior to legally establishing NASA and transferring all of the employees over to NASA, they disbanded the West Area Computing Group. So that was the end, not just of racial segregation in those work structures, but also of the gender segregation. Uh-huh. The white female group had been disbanded in a decade earlier. And so this group was segregated still both by gender and by race. And so when the West Area Computers were disbanded, it ended both the racial and the gender segregation there at NASA.
I see. So Dr. Darden, if I can just turn back to you here. It's so fascinating for so many reasons to me. But that what so did it as an African-American woman, did it feel like you were almost entering another world when you went to work in the late 60s? Given that outside of the grounds of the NASA facilities you worked with, America was still a profoundly racially divided country?
That was new to me. I had had white professors before, but not been embedded in a mostly white environment. So working almost totally with Caucasians was very new to me, and it took some adjusting.
Okay. So tell me more about the actual work, right? I was like, what was it like working with Katherine Johnson? How did you, like, when you sat across the table or to tackle tough problems, what was that like?
Okay. I did not work directly with NASA, with Katherine on any NASA projects.
Okay.
I worked, she was over working on flight management programs, I believe. I went into the hypersonics complex when I was assigned there in 1967. That's where the wind tunnels generated speeds up into the tens and twenties factors times the speed of sound. And that was where they did a lot of the research on how fast can these Apollo vehicles come back into the atmosphere and the vehicle not get so hot that it would burn up. Or how, what angle would these vehicles have to come back into the atmosphere such that they did not bounce on the atmosphere and bounce back out into space? So those were two of the very important parameters that had to be provided by this reentry physics group. And so I worked on those, or the wind tunnels that were used to actually come up with these numbers. I actually worked on those for about 5 years.
Okay, so can I just ask you, I mean, I love how mathematicians describe their work, right? Because it's very matter of fact. It's like either the reentry vehicle can just ricochet off the surface of the atmosphere and like go launch back out into space like a rock off the surface of a lake, or you can, if the numbers aren't quite right, the vehicle burns up.
Yes, of course, when they've been in space, they're coming back into an atmosphere that is filled with molecules generating a lot of things that this vehicle is now flying through.
Right.
The atmosphere itself. And this atmosphere is causing, and the speed at which the vehicle is going, is causing the vehicle to heat up. So depending on what that vehicle is made of, you know the temperature at which it would burn up, or you know what is the limit of the speed you can handle because of what that vehicle is made of. Now, with the space shuttle and everything, they actually put extra panels on the outside to help absorb or deflect some of that heat away from the real body of the vehicle itself.
One of which failed for Columbia.
That is correct.
That's right. So friction is both your enemy and your friend in this case.
Yes.
But so I suppose this is just me visualizing what we see in the movies. Like, did you really just oftentimes in order to solve these complex problems, were you like standing in front of giant boards of data and equations and informations and sorting through it to come out with the precise numbers at the end? How did you do it?
Well, you often do that. If you figure out what you're doing and there are governing equations for certain things that you start working with. And then we're using the mathematical concepts of how to solve problems and things like that to work through the equations. Now, another thing that was different when I got there was they had Fortran computers, as the movie showed you. When I got there, Dorothy Vaughan was working in the computational building, and she was the Fortran go-to person. Anybody who was trying to write a Fortran program that had a question would actually go and consult with Dorothy Vaughan. So I had actually learned how to program in Fortran before I went to NASA. Mm-hmm. And so many of the equations and things that were brought into the computer office for me to work on, I could write computer programs to solve them.
I see. But so this is an interesting point, because when you began there, you weren't considered an engineer though, right?
I was not. I was hired. My technical title was data analyst. I had a master's degree in applied mathematics, but I did sit in the computer office with the other ladies.
Okay, so but it's an important thing to distinguish, though, because the engineers were still largely men.
They were.
And was there a path? Did you have to fight for the path to forward in order to be recognized by NASA as an engineer?
What I did, I was actually wondering one day. I said the equations that they brought to me were very similar to equations that I studied in graduate school. And I said, well, I wonder why all the men are over there and all the women are sitting in computer offices. And I says, I guess it's because they have engineering degrees. And someone spoke up as I was thinking that out loud and says, oh, no, there are several men over there that have mathematics degrees. And I said, oh, is that right? So when I heard that, I did start to ask questions about transferring to engineering, because applied mathematics is is a step almost toward engineering.
Right.
And so I went to an immediate supervisor and I was told, no, I couldn't do that. And a few weeks later, I went to a director several levels higher and asked why a male and a female coming there with the same background were assigned to such different jobs, and how the male employees in the engineering office, did research, gave talks, wrote papers, published papers, and were promoted. And this was not generally the path that the computers took. They would do what the engineers asked them to do, and you know, would work and plot figures for the final reports that they were trying to present so that they could be sent to all the aeronautics industries in the country. There was not a typical method, but one of the things that disturbed me, NASA had a great graduate program. But when I first asked about taking classes in the graduate program, I was told that the women computers did not qualify for that. Ah. You had to be an engineer to qualify for taking classes in the program, the graduate program. And so when I asked the director that question, and some weeks later I was transferred to engineering, I then became eligible to enter the graduate program. And so I signed up for the doctorate in engineering program then.
Yeah. So interesting. So the reason why I wanted to have you explain that to us, Dr. Darden, is that the human computers, as you were saying, were asked to do the computational work, whereas the engineers were essentially taking that work and then doing the design. Is that a simple but right way of describing it?
Well, yes. They were trying to create these reference books that, you know, on airfoil shapes, wing shapes, things like that, and send them to all of the aerodynamic companies in the country such that everybody had this information to work as they were designing.
Right. So Margo, let me turn back to you, because when Katherine Johnson first then starts at NASA, I mean, that's part of the story here, right, is that the massive amounts of computational work were considered women's work, right?
Yeah, that's true. I mean, in the long history of computing, we think of computers now as electronic, you know, machines that we have on our desktops and in our hands. And we think of it as this overwhelmingly male field, whereas for so long, women sitting in rooms doing math was the standard for computing. And so computer was a job title. It was the name or the title for someone who sat in a room and did computations. They were all hired. The idea in the very beginning when they were hiring these women was that this was work that could be done like a secretarial pool or a clerical pool. And they had the women in the offices and they would sort of batch process the work. An engineer would come in with an assignment. The supervisor would assign it to, you know, a particular woman. And then, that was the way the workflow happened. This is sort of an interesting situation that we're in right now, where we think of perhaps women as not being good at math, women as being absent from the field of computation, when for much of the 20th century, that was not true.
Interesting. Well, let's get a quick call here. Let's go to Mary Lynn, who's calling from Duxbury, Massachusetts. Mary Lynn, you're on the air.
Hi, I have a question for Ms. Sutterly. I wondered if she had done any research as to salary comparisons of men and women, where the men and women were doing similar work, even though they might be in a different job description. They were doing similar work. And I found Ms. Darden's description of there were also mathematicians in the engineering department who were male. I would think there would be some good comparisons there to make. Well, and I'll take my answer off the air.
Yeah, and Mary Lynn, thank you for your call. And just as a gentle correction, it's Margo Lee Shetterly. But thank you for the question, Mary Lynn. Margo, you have an answer for her?
I do. I can tell you, particularly in the early years, women tended to be hired in as sub-professionals. So we know that the government has a job classification system. GS is what it, you know, it, many people may be familiar with that. So during the period leading up to World War II and during the war, you might be hired in as a professional, which was a P with different levels, subprofessional, which was SP with different levels, and then clerical with different levels. Most of the women were hired in as SP meaning subprofessional. And so what that meant is that even if they were doing the same work, producing the same kind of output as the men, the fact that they were hired in as subprofessionals meant that they were, according to the government classification system, paid less money. And in fact, that was one of the reasons there were several memos from the very early days of these computing pools. That was really one of the attractive factors explicitly mentioned in these memos, was that you could hire these girls. They were all called girls at the time. You could hire these girls in the computing pools. They dramatically improved the efficiency of the research process, and it was very cost effective because you could pay them less than the men.
Well, we are remembering Katherine Johnson this hour. She was the pioneering mathematician who helped put Americans on the moon. She died last week at the age of 101. We've got a lot more to discuss when we come back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are remembering Katherine Johnson this hour. She's the pioneering NASA mathematician, one of a group of African-American women who were central in America's very earliest efforts to get to the moon. Katherine Johnson died last week at the age of 101. Well, let's listen to a little bit of what she said back in 2011 in an interview with WHRO's What Matters. And Katherine Johnson talked about efforts that she had to put forth in those early days at NASA, breaking barriers put up against her due to sexism.
When the space program came along, I just happened to be working with guys, and when they had briefings on it, I asked permission to go. And they said, well, the girls don't usually go. And I said, well, is there a law? They said, no. I said, well, so then my boss said, let her go. And I began attending the briefings. You're already doing the work, but you didn't know exactly what it was. And gradually I did more, and they'd do something that I knew more about the geometry of the program, all about the mapping to the here and there. And this. So it was a very easy transition.
Katherine Johnson in 2011. Just a few years later, in 2015, President Barack Obama awarded her the Presidential Medal of Freedom.
Katherine calculated the flight path for America's first mission in space. The path that put Neil Armstrong on the moon. She was even asked to double check the computer's math on John Glenn's orbit around the Earth. So if you think your job is pressure packed, hers meant that forgetting to carry the one might send somebody floating off into the solar system.
President Barack Obama in 2015, as he awarded Katherine Johnson the Presidential Medal of Freedom. Let's go to Sarah, who's calling from Jamestown, New York. Sarah, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I really just wanted to say to Dr. Darden, thank you so much. It's really inspirational as a young woman listening to stories like that and just, you know, thank you for persevering and breaking down these barriers and putting in that work. It's really great to hear. It's really inspirational.
Well, Sarah, thank you for your call. Christine Darden, did you want to respond to Sarah?
I would just like to say thank you. I am speaking to a lot of young women just this day because they all talk about how inspired they are by the stories that we tell.
So let me ask you, Christine, if I may. You began working at NASA in 1967. And, of
yes.
course, it was July 20th, 1969 that Apollo 11 or that Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin walked on the moon. So were you working on the Apollo program in those first 2 years?
I was not the vehicle itself.
Okay.
Most of those parameters that I spoke of had been determined for the Apollo vehicles about how fast they could come back into the atmosphere and things like that. But the wind tunnels and things that were in the facility that they were using to determine that, there were times that adjustments had to be made in the wind tunnel to make sure that those numbers were correct, since they were basing some of those answers on data coming from the wind tunnels there on the field.
I see. The reason why I ask is because Margot Lee Shetterly, you were saying earlier, and we heard that clip at the very top of the show of Katherine Johnson herself saying that it was her work on Apollo 11, I think, that she was most proud of. Is that right? Am I remembering that correctly?
Yes. Anytime I asked her about that, and I remember in particular having going over and having dinner with her and her husband. We had this wonderful, very long dinner, you know, several years ago. And that was what she said, that work on those on the Apollo 11 parking orbit was the thing that she really felt most proud of.
OK, so by parking orbit, we mean the
When the lunar orbiter that was
that Michael Collins
around,
was in
orbiting around the moon, and the lunar lander then went down to the moon's surface. And I think Catherine's quote was something like, "There's only one bus to get back to the Earth, and we have to make sure that they catch that bus."
Oh my God. Oh, yes, indeed. There's only one bus for 250,000 miles.
Exactly.
Christine, did you ever talk with Catherine about her work on Apollo 11?
No, I didn't.
Okay.
Most of the time when Catherine and I were together, we were talking about church things,
yeah.
or I was in a technical society with Catherine in which we worked with a lot of students in the community and high school students, middle school students, and college students in encouraging them in the STEM area. And those who were already in college, if they had technical jobs during the summer, encouraging them to come in to a conference we held in which they would give talks about the work that they had done. So we worked with quite a few students in trying to develop their abilities in explaining what they had done in their work and enjoying the work that they were doing, hoping that they would stay in the fields.
Okay. Well, we're remembering this hour, Katherine Johnson, who died last week at the age of 101. Let's go to Michael, who's calling from Syracuse, New York. Michael, you're on the air.
Thank you. So Katherine's brilliance is clear, but I'm curious how she got there. I understand that her parents had to make some extraordinary sacrifices in order to get her to where she could be. So I was wondering if Margot Lee could comment a little bit about her upbringing and those sacrifices.
Yeah, Michael, thank you for that question, actually. So Margot Lee, go ahead.
So Katherine Johnson was born in White Sulphur Springs, West Virginia, rural part of West Virginia. Her mother was a teacher. Her father was a blacksmith and a farmer, eventually went to work at the Greenbrier Hotel, which is there in town. But she talked always about how smart her parents were and how important it was for their kids, there were four of them, to get educated. West Virginia was segregated at the time. There were no schools for black students beyond, I think it was fifth grade, not even sixth grade. I think it was fifth grade. And so they sent their kids away to West Virginia State Institute, as it was called then, historically black college, to be educated. There was a laboratory school. Many colleges had this. I know Hampton University had one of these where they train teachers, and then there is also a lower school there, you know, like for children to go to school. And that's where Catherine and her siblings were educated. But she talked about the importance that that her parents placed on education and making sure all of their kids were educated. The other thing is she had a very influential teacher at college, a guy named W.W. Shefflin Clater. He was the third African-American PhD in math from the University of Pennsylvania. And he recognized her talent. And he said, you know, Catherine, I don't know where you're going to find a job. You know, this is back in 1928, I think. I don't know where you're going to find a job, but I am going to train you as a research mathematician. She eventually did some graduate school, but then she became a public school teacher. And it took more than a decade and a half for her to find this job at NASA working for Dorothy Vaughan. But, you know, she had people along the way who believed in her and who trained her to make sure that whatever it was she ended up doing, she would do her best work. But that, you know, if she was able to find a job as a mathematician, she would be prepared.
Right. But is there any question that whether... there's no question that Catherine Johnson and that other first group of women, they cleared the way to help other women who came later to help find those jobs.
I think that's absolutely true. I think it's true both in terms of inspiration and showing that it could be done. It was true in terms of the network. So many people find their jobs because they know people already in similar jobs. So they were able to pass the word through the many different community and social organizations that they all belong to. And I certainly, as somebody who grew up in a community with these women, with Catherine Johnson, with Dr. Darden, you know, my dad is a NASA, now retired NASA research scientist. He was also part of the National Technical Association that Dr. Darden was talking about. It is an incredible thing to grow up in a community where you look around and, you know, there are all these scientists, mathematicians, engineers. And it wasn't a big deal. It was something that you got to accept as a given. Who had full lives as, you know, going to church and Girl Scout troop leaders and things like that as well. So the legacy of these women and that pioneering generation of women is very, very long lasting.
Yeah. And I have to say, you know, shame on the rest of us for not knowing these stories until Margot Lee Shetterly, you published your amazing book. And thank you for doing that. But to your point, like there was this community there. And I just wish we had known about it before you published your book. But here we are now. Christine Darden, Dr. Darden, let me turn back to you. Because all the, you know, in talking about, you know, your groundbreaking work, Catherine Johnson's groundbreaking work, that old quote of, if I have seen farther, it's because I have stood on the shoulders of giants, and passing in through my head here. Did you feel the sort of the responsibility that comes with being a pioneer in this field in terms of keeping the way clear for young people, who young women in particular, who might want to follow you?
Well, certainly to inspire them to prepare themselves for careers like that. When I graduated, got my master's degree, I had not thought of what I was going to do with it. I really loved the applied mathematics itself. But when I went by the placement office, the young lady said, "Didn't you know NASA was here yesterday recruiting?" I said, "No, I didn't know that." And so it is because of the excellent work that the ladies had done at NASA Langley that they were still recruiting at all of these schools, just in Virginia and in the neighboring colleges and things in the neighboring states.
Wow. Well, let's get one more call. Let's go to Charles, calling from Moorhead City, North Carolina. Charles, you're on the air.
Hello. Thank you. I had a comment that this lady, Miss Johnson, is amazing. I wish they'd put her on the $100 bill and Rosa Parks on the $20 bill. And I'm just glad finally this kind of history is coming out.
Yeah. Well, Charles, thank you so much for that call and for that comment. I want to play another moment from an interview that Katherine Johnson herself did in 2011, because we've been talking so much about female mathematicians and young girls in the STEM fields. And so here's what Johnson said in 2011 on WHRO's What Matters about just the fundamental importance of asking questions.
It was important to me to learn why. Girls, some of them are reluctant to ask questions. They feel that they're just being curious, but if you want to know, you ask a question. There's no such thing as a dumb question. It's dumb if you don't ask it. But girls are capable of doing everything men are capable of doing. Sometimes they have more imagination.
Katherine Johnson in 2011. Margot Lee Shetterly and Christine Darden, last couple of questions, and we've got about 3 minutes left here. So, and Margot, let me start with you. What do you think Katherine's Johnson legacy, her legacy is today?
I really think that the legacy is twofold. First of all, is the work. You know, we really have to remember that she put in the hours, she put in the preparation, she was the right person at the right time, and she is the author of that work, of those pioneering equations. So we always want to remember her for that work. And then I think that we remember her for the symbolic value, for showing that when you look for talent everywhere, you find it. You know, that she was a Black woman in the South, segregated South, in a time when women couldn't even get credit cards in their own names. And here's a woman who raised her hand and said, I'm the person to help send the man into orbit and bring him home safely. So I think it is both the work that she did and the symbol of what is possible when we look for talent everywhere.
Absolutely. Dr. Darden, what do you think her legacy is?
Well, the work that she did, certainly this entire country is dreaming of Katherine Johnson now, and we run into it everywhere we go. And she has inspired so many young people in this country who are willing. I've had them even say, I'm going back and do my homework now because I want to be like that. I want to do something like that. Because before that, they didn't know that women did that kind of work.
Wow. I have to say, I mean, they didn't know that women did that kind of work. And the work is so cool, right?
Yes.
I mean, it sounds like, talking to you, Dr. Darden, it sounds like you love, not just loved, but love it to this day.
I absolutely do. I had a great career at NASA.
And so what about you? What do you see in your immediate future?
Well, I've been trying to inspire young people to make sure that they do know about the careers that are available to them. And I've seen the country is having more and more events where they are bringing young girls in and telling about the jobs in a different certain area and what that entails and what they need to do to prepare for those jobs. Mm-hmm. And this is something we need to have our students, girls and some guys in many instances, understand.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Darden, not only for your work at NASA, but as you just said, encouraging the next generation of explorers in this country. Dr. Christine Darden was awarded the Congressional Gold Medal in 2019 and worked at NASA from 1967 until 2007. And Margot Lee Shetterly, author of Hidden Figures, The American Dream and the Untold Story of the Black Women Mathematicians Who Helped Win the Space Race. Thank you for helping us remember Katherine Johnson today.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.